All right, thank you. Second panel of the morning on terror, risky perception of terrorists, how there is a misperception of potential terrorists. And we will start the session with Bruce.
So I want to talk about two things that sort of fall into this general category. First is something that's known by most people, and then sort of leading into something about selling security and something else more about terrorism. Most people in the room, I assume, are familiar with prospect theory, which is a bunch of experiments. The most common one that's sort of relevant here is you ask people to choose between a sure gain of $500 and a coin flip at $1,000, and about 3/4 of people will choose the sure gain. If you ask people to choose between a sure loss of $500 and a coin flip loss at $1,000, most people will take the risky loss. That people tend to be risk averse when it comes to gains and risk seeking when it comes to losses. Very well known result, and been repeated again and again across ages, genders, cultures, even across species. Now, this is something that most of us seem to share. I think it can be pretty easily explained evolutionarily. Right? If you assume a species, as most do, tend to live at the edge of survival, then a sure gain, even though it's smaller, means you're going to live to see another day. Whereas taking a risk at a larger gain is not necessarily the best strategy, because if you lose, you won't live to see the other day. Looking at the other half, right, a sure loss, even though it might be smaller, you know, could mean the end. It could mean you're not going to survive. So taking the risk of no loss at all is preferable to taking that sure loss. So now this has been written about in a lot of books, but I think that has a really interesting implications in selling security, whether it be products or policy. It's sort of a truism in sales that there are two ways to sell something, either fear or greed. Right? You can sell something somebody actually wants, like, you know, pretty much everything, you know, we tend to buy, or you can sell something to prevent something someone doesn't want. Right? Buying a door lock, buying insurance. And those are those two ways to sell something. And it's also well known among salespeople that it's easier to sell greed than fear. That you're much better off selling something someone does want rather than something someone doesn't. And if you talk to people who sell insurance, I mean, they'll tell you it's hard to get people to buy insurance. You talk to people who sell burglar alarm systems. They'll tell you that someone buys a burglar alarm either when they've been robbed or when one of their neighbors has been robbed. That that selling fear is harder. And you can look at that from the lens of prospect theory. That when you're selling fear, when you're selling prevention of something, you're trying to convince somebody to accept a smaller loss, the cost of the thing, as opposed to risking a larger loss, the damage you'd get if the bad thing happens to you. And those of us who deal in computer security, especially in companies, know how hard it is to convince our bosses to accept that sure smaller loss. That is very common for a CEO or a CIO or any senior management to say, you know, let's take the risk. It didn't happen to us last year and we're okay. You know, that bad thing in the news, that happens to those companies, not us. That it is natural to see that risk-seeking behavior when it comes to losses. Now, in the industry, there have been two basic responses to this. One is sort of a series of marketing slogans you see in various security companies, things like, we take care of your security so you can take care of your business. Right? That's an attempt to turn a fear sell into a greed sell. Right? Buy my security thing because it'll actually make you more money. The other thing we see is I'm going to call it a fetish for ROI models. This is return on investment models, which is basically a spreadsheet specifically jury-rigged to convince the buyer that if he buys the security thing, he's going to make money somehow. I mean, basically, both strategies are kind of complete bullshit. They don't work very well. Right? Security is fundamentally a fear sell. And that's a problem for the industry. I don't think it's going to change. The other strategy you see, which is far more successful, is that when you actually have a fear sell, the way to make it work is to push the fear button really, really hard. Because although people are more inclined to take a risk for greed, sorry, to buy the thing for greed, they ought to buy the thing for fear. If they are actually scared, right, making someone feel not scared trumps sort of all of this. So in the security industry, we call it fear, uncertainty, and doubt, where companies try to make it a really big deal, right, of whether it's phishing or identity theft or computer viruses, right, your computer will die, you will lose money if you don't buy my thing. Now, in public policy, you know, we've seen terrorism used in the same way, right, to justify a lot of policies that under the normal, whether it's a positive or a negative, people wouldn't accept. If they're scared, they actually accept it. So that's sort of the first point I wanted to make. The second is something by someone else, not by me. It's an article by Max Abrams. And what he did is he looked at correspondent inference theory. Basically, correspondent inference theory says that people tend to judge the reason for an action by the effects of that action. So a common experiment would be an experimenter sits with a subject in a room. There's some noise coming from outside the room. The experimenter stands up and goes and closes the door. The noise lessens. Most people will say that the experimenter closed the door in order to lessen the noise. That's what the effect was, so that's what the cause must have been. Right? And then we'll tend to downplay any other possible causes. You see this reaction in terrorism. It's, you know, I've always sort of wondered why people would say things like Islamic terrorism is different. Right, the terrorism we're seeing now is different. And there are people who have said, very common, that the motivations is to kill us all. That this is why Al-Qaeda bin Laden is doing what he's doing. It's actually kind of frustrating for bin Laden. It's very, very funny. His aims are well known. They've been written down. And they haven't changed over the years. And over the past like 5 or so years, he said a couple of times, you guys don't get why I'm doing this. Right? But there's a tendency to believe that because that the effects of terrorism were to kill people, that the purpose of the terrorism were to kill people and not to end U.S. support of Israel, to get American troops out of the Middle East, particularly Saudi Arabia, to end the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, to end the U.S. support of other sort of secular Muslim countries' governments. I mean, those are the stated goals of bin Laden and by extension, Al-Qaeda. So that's sort of what I wanted to say here. Those sort of two sort of interesting psychology experiments and theories that will inform the debate on security and terrorism.
Frank Furedi, professor of sociology at the University of Kent, an expert in risk consciousness. In fact, one of his latest book is The Culture of Fear, and after September 11, you'll be doing lots of studies on the reaction, psychological reaction to those events.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I feel like a bit of an interloper coming in from a different space, but I certainly have managed to learn quite a lot through you. The contribution I want to make centers on what I called the culture of fear back in the 20th century. And the thing that I've been looking at the last 10 years, trying to make sense of, is what I call the rules of fear. By the rules of fear, what I mean is, what are the rules of fear that are distinct to the way that we experience the world? What is distinct about the way we fear compared to previous generations in the past and different cultures, historically and in other geographic spaces? And although I haven't got time to go into it, for the purposes of this discussion, it seems to me that one of the central rules of fear that pertains to the online experience but also towards terrorism is the fact that in our culture, and that's predominantly the Anglo-American culture, increasingly fear has become disassociated from its object. In other words, we increasingly worry about the fear of something rather than the something. So in virtually every law and order jurisdiction, every police force, whether it's in England or in the United States, when you read their mission statement, they always say the same thing. It's almost as if the same guy wrote the mission statement for all these police forces. If you look at their mission statement, number one of their mission is to fight crime, which is fine. And that's why they're there. We're here to fight crime. But number two in every mission statement is to fight the fear of crime. And it's a very interesting distinction that they make. Number one, we will fight crime. Number two, we'll fight the fear of crime. And I think what's very interesting is that in the last 20 years, most police forces and most security agencies actually spend more time fighting the fear of crime than crime itself, for a variety of reasons. The most important reason is that it's much easier to be seen to be doing something than actually doing something. In other words, it's much easier to create the impression that everything is all right, you know, sort of the streets are clean, there aren't any beggars anymore on the street, than to do the something useful that fights the existential sources of people's insecurity. And I think it's interesting because when you're fighting the fear of crime, what you're saying is that the perception of crime is more important than what's objectively or happening in reality. And therefore, what we're going to be doing is essentially reducing the challenge of security to that of impression management. And I think that virtually everything that you see and you read about in the headlines about crime or terrorism is in reality a form of impression management. That's what it's really all about. You have a bomb go off in London, and the guys come out with the white suits and the space masks, you know, sort of, and they hover around, and you have the forensic scientists who create this kind of crime zone. It becomes almost a ritual that has clear symbolisms attached to it, which creates the impression that everything is under control, we're doing what needs to be done. And I think it's interesting, one of my friends is in charge of policing all the infrastructure and transport in Britain, and he makes the point he cannot understand why, for example, we leave these crime scenes, you know, sort of intact for weeks and months, even though there's no reason for it. We could easily get rid of it after 2 days and get back and London back to normal again. But it serves a purpose. It's a way of creating the impression that something important is being done. And what I argue that happens is that as we become more and more concerned about the fear of something rather than the thing itself, impression management continually encourages us to produce what I call fantasy documents. And if you read most security documents or risk management documents that are written, again, you get the impression it's the same guy that wrote the mission statements also writes these documents on security and risk management. They all read the same. It's almost like a template that he's got a patent on, and it doesn't matter whether it's a hospital or a school, you know, sort of, it always begins, or we are committed to keeping our customers safe, you know, sort of, that's like the buzzword, and the language reads very, very similarly. The trouble is that these fantasy documents not only do very little to provide a positive future-oriented orientation towards providing people with real security, as I argue, they contribute towards making us more anxious and ultimately making us feel far more insecure than is the case at the moment. In my most recent book, which is called Invitation to Terror, what I argue is as the main problem facing us is that terrorism is increasingly fought from a vulnerability-led response. It's almost as if we begin with the fact that we feel vulnerable, and in a one-dimensional sense, we exaggerate and inflate our powerlessness. I mean, I couldn't believe it when President Bush said, after 9/11, America the vulnerable. Now, here's the most powerful nation on the world, and, you know, can you imagine Winston Churchill saying, you know, at the time of the Blitzkrieg, you know, England the vulnerable, you know, sort of, it would have been unthinkable for any serious statesman in the middle of a war or in the beginning of the war to basically begin from the sensibility of weakness and powerlessness. And the trouble is that once you begin to think of yourself in that way, it's very difficult to avoid the conclusion that all of us in this room are nothing other but walking targets. And we end up looking for targets. I mean, the whole world becomes one big target, and every business, every institution draws up its list of potential targets, demanding money that those targets should be reinforced and saved, all the while forgetting that in this kind of way, in this kind of response, we're actually inviting others to terrorize us with not very much resources, and they don't require very much of an effort. It seems to me that this is, in many respects, the major problem that we're faced. I think we all recognize that the impact of terror in any form, whether online or offline, is ultimately determined by our response to it. If people don't want to be terrorized, if they're casual about it, if they're relaxed about it, then the way they experience terror is very, very different than if communities are encouraged to pee in their pants and to kind of roll over and think of themselves as being incredibly traumatized. And I think that's important to remember time and time again. My own work is devoted towards displacing a vulnerable-led response to a resilience-led response. I think the key element in any response in terms of security is to find the sources of our resilience, both community-wise in institutions and organizations, and also in terms of individuals. I think experience shows us that we don't need to reorganize our life around the potential threat of terror. We can learn to live with terror, live with it. It doesn't mean to say you acquiesce to it or you give in to it, but you learn to minimize its impact by taking measures that allow you to carry on with life in a positive way. Seems to me that the main problem with vulnerability-led responses is it intensifies our sense of insecurity. It makes us more insecure. Recently, I've done a bit of research. In fact, it was published in England last week, a report called License to Hug. And what I've done here was basically deal with children, you know, and the way that children are meant to be experiencing pedophilia, because it's a much easier subject to deal with than terror. There's far less national security concerns going on. And what's happening in England is that because of all the hysteria about pedophiles, and it is a hysteria, the government has set up a criminal records bureau whereby adults that come anywhere near a child need to be police checked. And it's a very thorough check that you have to undergo. My wife, for example, who runs an organization that provides reproductive health for women and never sees a child, has now undergone 3 police checks, just in case a child might, you know, sort of bump into her in a clinic. And what's interesting about this is that because these checks were introduced, increasingly parents in England do not trust other parents who do not have a police check. And I've known stories where, for example, a mother told me that her child went over to her friend's house to play there. The first thing that she wanted to know, were those parents police checked? In other words, you get a situation where the demand to be checked, the demand for more information just expands all the time. By the end of next year, 1 out of 3 working adults in England would have been police checked in order to sort of meet the right kind of criteria. Now, what does that mean? Well, what that means is that we not only worry about the pedophiles, and there are very few of them, if the truth be known. It's not that as if they hang around, you know, every street corner. We're not just simply worried about pedophiles. We're increasingly worried about adults who haven't been police checked. In other words, through institutionalizing insecurity towards our children, we've created a new security problem that did not exist before. 20 years ago, nobody was worried if I was police checked or not. You know, so that wasn't a concern. Today, That's a calculation that parents make. And I think that's really how security policy often inadvertently evolves, particularly in relation to terrorism, but also into other areas. In other words, you're creating, in response to insecurity, more sources of insecurity. And through that, what you do is you wear down the resilience of a community, its ability to deal with these kinds of pressures. And that is really, to me, one of the most important questions that we need to sort of confront. One of the same kind of questions also exist online. I experience it every month, especially in a university environment, where all my colleagues, you know, sort of have this addiction towards passing on emails that give you virus alerts. You know, I don't know why academics are so silly, but they're the most obsessive individuals about that, and thereby creating a situation where the absence of a problem is kind of to create new problems just simply by reacting in this vulnerability sense. I want to make one final point, which is this conference began when Bruce drew a distinction between two things, you know, perceptions and reality, or feeling, as he put it, the way we feel and the way things really are. And I think it's useful to see things in that way. But in a sense, these two very different dimensions of our life can be mediated if you understand that feeling makes sense through meaning. The way the meaning that we endow insecurity or sources of insecurity ensures that meaning and the reality are brought into a relationship to one another. And one of the questions that confronts us, all of us in this room, is the extent to which we can give security meaning. The extent to which individuals feel that they can be responsible for their own security. The extent to which the kind of advice they get means something to them, not something that comes down from on top, isn't just bureaucratically transmitted to them, but corresponds to their lived experience. And that is really the big challenge for everybody, no matter whether you're involved in on the technical side or on the social side, of how we collectively confront this question of meaning, whereby security is something that means something to us, rather than a set of procedures on the back of a fantasy document. Thank you.
Richard Young, the professor of psychology at USC and an expert in the field of quantitative psychology, and specifically the application of formal models as well as computational models to understand the perception of terrorist risk, as well as the modeling as well of terrorist attack decisions.
And clearly not an expert at hooking my computer up to all the... Okay. I actually had come planning not to use PowerPoint, but with all the PowerPoints, I was social pressure to use PowerPoints. It was overwhelming. Despite the University of Southern California's recent admonition to their faculty regarding death by PowerPoint, essentially something that Bill Gates has left for us, this wonderful tool called PowerPoint. Anyway, the research I'm going to talk about, actually the ideas I'm going to talk about, are things I've developed with Heather Rosoff and some other members of the CREATE research team. CREATE is was the first university program funded by the Department of Homeland Security, and it's a joint venture from the School of Engineering and the School of Policy Planning and Development. Detlef von Winterfeld is the director of that institute or of that center, and I suppose I'm the token psychologist member for that group. There are actually other centers that focus more on psychology. What I want to talk about today is some work that we've done on the problem of threat assessment. And in particular, this is going to sound like I was taking notes from Bruce, actually from a few other speakers here today. on the notion of perspective taking. There's a number of different folkways, I will call them, that DHS and others who are charged with the responsibility of assessing threat go about doing their job. The first one that I heard when I came on board with this center about 5 years ago was that, you know, if the terrorists can possibly think about it, we have to mitigate. We have to think about it. We have to worry about it. And so there was no sense of what the terrorists were likely to do. It was simply, if it's possible, then we have to guard against it. So it's a little bit like a mini-MAC strategy. More recently, in fact, I was at a conference in Monterey where I was bombarded with numerous schemes for assessing threat that DHS is using. And they all had this underlying assumption that it's a zero-sum game. That is, what's bad for us is good for the terrorists. They're what I would call egocentric, in the sense that the only values that matter are ours, right? The terrorists can't possibly have their own unique set of objectives and values, that they're just going off of what's bad for us. And so if it's somewhat costly, if it's a potential loss for us, then that's a big problem. And the terrorists are going to take advantage of that. So those are folkways that I would like to put behind us, or at least think a little bit differently about the problem of threat assessment. And there actually is a lot of work on this psychological notion of perspective taking, generally associated with negotiation, the idea that perspective taking will help you in negotiation. I think one of the problems that it hasn't really been used that much in this domain is that it's often confused with empathy. Perspective taking and empathy are really not the same thing. It's difficult to separate that out, I think, for some people, but they really are not the same thing. It requires, in this context, certainly, a realization that your opponent, your adversary's motives, are unique. Their motivations are perhaps enduring and quite independent of your own values. Ignoring your opponent's motivations and not taking their perspective, in other words, focusing only on what's bad for you, really drives us to think in terms of our own, what I could call, darkest fears. They really force you. A lot of people have talked about this already, really focus you to think about what is the worst that could happen to me, as opposed to thinking in terms of, well, what is it my opponent wants? What is he likely to do, or she likely to do? And sort of what are the most likely attacks that I should think about defending against? Now, I mentioned that I'm a psychologist, but I have a lot of interest and background in formal modeling using sort of standard decision analytic, risk analytic tools from operations research. And so we took a fairly straightforward approach to this and said, well, let's think about a terrorist organization, perhaps OBL, perhaps any terrorist CEO. He has problems just like any Fortune 500 executive would have. He has certain initiatives for the year. He has things that he wants to accomplish, goals. He has a mission that he has to somehow address. And there are a number of different options that he might have in front of him at the beginning of the year. Beliefs about what the impact of going down various paths might be. And there's a very stable value structure. I was so happy to hear Bruce say that. It's amazing how much you can rely on the values and the objectives that have been stated and repeated over and over. They're on websites. And so far, from what I know, these organizations have not done anything that would cause me to believe that those are not actually their stated values. I would submit that you can rely on their objectives to a much greater extent than you can anyone running for president here in this country right now. They're a lot more predictable. So this part of this is really building a methodology, but the idea here is that you would have intelligence experts. Unfortunately, intelligence experts, at least, and I don't have a security clearance, but I know from some work I've done that they tend to focus more on what's information that's coming in about activity, things like this, and not so much on objectives and values. That may be a small part of it. But it would cause, this particular methodology does force an expert to focus more on the values and what I would call sort of value-structured thinking. It's a term that Ralph Keeney coined, to help us think about what it is that the terrorists really want. And so we've developed a methodology. We've used it with what I would call proxy analysts, people who know a little bit more about terrorism than I do, people who've read a lot more, and people who are would be considered experts on that part of the world. This is an overview of the methodology, where we start with a decision about different attack alternatives. There's an event tree that incorporates the beliefs about what we or what the terrorists would believe about what they could accomplish, what they could get away with, and how they would actually execute the attack. We then have a value structure. This is the value-focused thinking part of this, in which we scale the various alternatives against attributes that are designed to measure each of these objectives. And from this, we incorporate uncertainties. There are a number of uncertainties that we as the analysts have about the terrorist beliefs and objectives. Some of these are uncertainties that are inherent in the context of the problem. Other uncertainties are really uncertainties that we have in that we may not know exactly what the terrorist is thinking, the terrorist organization, terrorist leader is thinking. Those get all rolled into the same probability distributions, and ultimately we Monte Carlo this out. So this is an example of about 10 different attack alternatives, including a no-attack baseline. One of the questions that we've asked, in fact, we've done some of this with our own subjects, is why do you think there hasn't been a terrorist attack? And some of those attributions have to do with things that were mentioned yesterday, well, we're doing a better job, we're fighting the terrorists somewhere else, it just takes time to execute an attack, and a few other things. One of the possibilities is that it's really to the terrorist advantage right now not to attack in the U.S., and so we threw that in as one of the alternatives. An event tree where we get essentially probabilities, but not only that, we get beta distributions over those parameters, reflecting what we think is a terrorist uncertainty about whether they can actually acquire the capability and material and resources, other resources, whether they would be interdicted along the way, and also whether they would actually successfully execute the attack. And this shows a little event tree with some betas over those probabilities. This is all assessed, and we've done this with about 5 different proxy experts so far. We then have this value tree elicitation where we also end up putting probability distributions over those each of those cells, the attribute by alternatives matrix. We even assess weights where we think of the terrorists having to trade off these different objectives. You see here that there are 3 overall fundamental objectives having to do with the organizational strength, the resources involved for that particular attack, and then the impact on the United States. One of the biggest impacts, of course, is to cause terror, to make us afraid. It's not so much that you kill people and you destroy things, but that you instill fear. And, of course, that may be a means to instilling fear, but there's some types of attack that maybe kill a lot of people that don't instill a lot of fear. And so you might have a trade-off between those things that you might think would ordinarily go together. Okay. From this, we end up being able to estimate a probability distribution over the value, the overall aggregate value for each of the attack alternatives. And in fact, this ends up being a risk profile for each of these attack alternatives, employing a choice, basic fundamental choice axiom. We're then able to derive probabilities. If you assume that at any given moment a terrorist chooses from that distribution the utility and picks the thing with the highest utility, you can end up with a probability. And so this is an example table from a few of our experts regarding that. Let me just conclude by saying that I'm really... I'm sorry?
You get the end of the slide. Then just leave it up.
Okay. Yeah, this table actually shows the diversity among experts. One of the things that we wanted to be able to show was that all of this wasn't just due to the structure of how we thought about the problem. That, in fact, we had different experts. And if you go into their models, you can really understand how they come up with these kinds of probabilities based on the inputs that they gave us. And that's a good thing, right? You want, I mean, someone brought this up earlier today. I think that's what Bayes said in the 1700s about subjective probability, that it really reflects your state of mind, not anything about necessarily the empirical world. It's really your state of mind. So what you're capturing with this is the state of mind of that intelligence analyst or expert. And this shows some discriminant validity, to use at least one psychological term. I guess I said perspective taking, two psychological terms. Discriminant validity in that we were able to show that different experts gave us different results there. Okay, I'm out of time.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Professor John Mueller. He's Professor of Political Science as well as Chair of National Security Studies at Ohio State University. He's an expert in defense policy, among other things. And his latest book, 2006, was on the title was Overblown.
Overblown, yeah.
And the terrorism industry inflate national security threat.
Right. Okay, really great to be here. Let me know if I'm talking too loud. I got one ear is clogged up from swimming, and I need to get a rotor rooted out, so I'm having some problem. If I'm talking loud, it's partly so I can hear myself. What I'd like to do is just briefly sort of outline some of the research I've done. The book that was mentioned, Overblown, came out 2 years ago. And it's basically got the main point of it is to deal with risk perception, I guess you could say, but really, from my standpoint, more threat perception. Looking at particularly international relations, which is my major field, and arguing basically that the threats that have been perceived by international actors, the United States in particular, since World War II, now that we know how things turned out, have almost always been massively exaggerated. Am I talking too loud? No, okay. I thought you were objecting back there, Randy. Then the argument is, well, they're constantly doing it in the past. Maybe we're at it again with respect to terrorism. So I've analyzed sort of the threat of terrorism, arguing that it's been massively, it's been overblown. If I were to do the book today, I would change the title probably from just overblown to massively overblown. Despite the fact that Michael Chertoff says that it presents a significant existential threat to the United States, differentiating it from all those trivial, you know, non-significant existential threats that we've had to worry about in the past, it seems to me it's basically not a very important threat. It's certainly not existential. Your chance of being killed by a terrorist, an international terrorist, if you live outside of a war zone, over an 80-year lifespan, is about 1 in 80,000. Your chance of being killed in an automobile crash, of course, is more like 1 in 80 if you're an American. That assumes, by the way, that there's another 9/11 every few years. If there isn't another 9/11 every few years and just continues at the present rate, your chances are more like 1 in 130,000 over 80 years, not per year, but over 80 years. This doesn't strike me as being a monumental problem. Since 9/11, there's three separate studies that basically enumerated all the attacks in the whole world outside of war zones that were al-Qaeda-like, al-Qaeda maybe, al-Qaeda wannabe, possibly, conceivably, but possibly related to al-Qaeda. And so I went through these lists. It includes, of course, London and Bali and Madrid and all that, and just sort of tallied out how many people have been killed in these attacks outside of war zones. And they all basically agree it's about 200 or 300 per year. That's 200 or 300 per year too many, but it's not exactly the end of the world. In the United States, the FBI, after years of spending tons of money and predicting that they would find al-Qaeda in the country, Robert Mueller, the FBI director's favorite phrase, which I call, "I think, therefore they are," is what really bothers me is the things we're not seeing. And they're here, and they have an infrastructure, and there are thousands of them, he was saying in 2003. They have not found any yet at all, zero. This is really impressive because the number of people, the number of foreigners who have entered the United States since 9/11 is about 2 billion, legally, plus a year, about 300 million people, foreigners enter this country every day, every year, legally. A lot of that includes not just airplanes, but truck drivers going back and forth over the Canadian border, for example. And some of those are from Winnipeg, which obviously is a hotbed of terrorism. And you have to be really careful. If you go to Winnipeg, you won't be able to find any terrorists, but that just shows how clever they are. At any rate, the fact that they haven't been able to get any in the country suggests probably that they haven't been trying very hard. And I think basically what's been happening is that the al-Qaeda threat is basically fading away fairly well, partly because of international policing and partly because of their own counterproductive activity. If you blow up a hotel in Jordan, it turns out Jordanians don't like being blown up any more than Americans or Brits do. And so the sympathy before hotels are blown up in Jordan toward Osama bin Laden is about 25% sort of like them. After the hotel bombings, it went down to less than 1%. Same thing happened just recently in Pakistan with the assassination of Bhutto. And same thing in Morocco. Same thing happened in Egypt. Same thing happened in Saudi Arabia. Same thing happened in Indonesia. Basically it's been counterproductive. Now there's polls which show in Iraq 100% of Iraqis hate al-Qaeda. I don't know how you get that. I never had a poll that got that high, but I can give you the site. The point is people don't like being blown up. You know, big surprise. Even Arabs don't like being blown up when they're at the shopping center. And so it's been heavily counterproductive. A lot of people are simply defecting. There's a bunch of articles just recently in The New Yorker and The New Republic on that. It seems that al-Qaeda now currently consists of maybe 200 people running around in the hills or hiding out in the hills of Pakistan, connecting very little to anybody else. Then they sort of the internet types who sort of talk to each other and say, let's blow something up. So they're a danger. They can do the bad thing. So the people in Pakistan can probably do something or other, maybe even another 9/11. But it's going to be a pretty limited kind of threat, not existential. And the people that get picked up, of course, tend to be fairly flaky many, many times, trying to take down the Brooklyn Bridge with an acetylene torch. The one guy caught in Florida, his master plan, in which Ashcroft said he was planning a ground offensive against the United States. His idea was he would blow up the Sears Tower. He needed some explosives, but he's working on that. The Sears Tower then collapse. It would then blow up nearby prison, from which people would then run. He would then go to these people, collect them, and make them part of his party, and he would then create a new country. He's now on trial. Somebody called up his mother, and with maternal affection, she said, "Are you kidding? He's crazy." My basic argument, that doesn't seem to be exactly a massive threat, and it's under control and getting lower, if anything. In fact, the number of attacks has gone down. The second point of the book is basically the question about the response. And my argument is that the response to terrorism has been greater and more destructive than what terrorism did, even in the case of 9/11, which is by far the most horrible terrorist attack in history. And I don't want to downplay the horror of that, obviously, or any of the other attacks, for that matter. One of the costs of it has been a counterproductive policy. More Americans, of course, have died in the war in Iraq than died on 9/11. The economic costs of that are running into trillions of dollars, et cetera. The other cost has been in case of fear, one of the main subjects we're dealing with. Fear is costly. I mean, fear is a good thing if someone's coming at you with a knife. You should be afraid. Good. However, unnecessary fear about things is basically a bad thing. It causes you pain. It reduces your life expectancy. People worry themselves to death, literally. The spectacular case with Chernobyl, there's now a big study about what has happened 20 years after the Chernobyl nuclear disaster in the Soviet Union in 1986. And the conclusion is that the radiation killed like zero people, 40 or 50, and that was because they sent in people too early to clean it up. But the big health cost has been in anxiety, suicide, people worrying about getting cancer. Anxiety, suicide, alcoholism, inability to work, lethargy, and ultimately reduced life expectancy. So fear is a big deal. It costs lives. In addition, after 9/11, as mentioned yesterday, about 1,000 Americans died because out of fear they drove rather than flew, simply between 9/11 and the end of that year. There's also a lot of policies that have cost lives. For example, the transportation, there's just a study, I don't think it's published yet, out of Cornell, economics department, which indicates that what's happened is because the Transportation Security Administration has increased the costs and the inconvenience of flying, that far fewer people are flying a short haul. And so instead they're driving. Driving is more dangerous. The number of people killed because of that is about 400 per year, which is more than Al-Qaeda has killed. So the TSA has been responsible for more deaths since 9/11 than has been Al-Qaeda. They're not morally equivalent, perhaps, but we've had that effect. Okay, I think what's also happening is kind of an internalized fear from a political science standpoint. I think this is interesting. It's not that people are running around like they once were, sort of, you know, in dire fear about a bomb coming out of the air or something, or they're now getting back on airplanes and so forth. But that they're just sort of this internalized thing, we have to do terrorism because it's a bad thing. The result of that is we've got a politically permissive atmosphere, which basically will continue what Richard Clark calls the self-licking ice cream cone. That it'll just keep going on and on and on and on, despite the fact nothing's happening. It's like fear of domestic communists during the Cold War. There were some spectacular cases. They went away. The FBI kept looking for communists. Or the drug war. I mean, it isn't even discussed. It's a self-licking ice cream cone. It doesn't enter the political fray. The book also deals with the terrorism industry, people who basically have an incentive to hype the fear. This would include politicians who are afraid if they don't say their terrorism is terrible, they won't get elected. This includes bureaucracies who obviously want to increase the amount of money they may get rather than reduce it. It includes journalists who basically find that anything I say is really boring as opposed to having things blow up in your face and they're exacerbating it. Yesterday, Mr. Randy used the phrase, there's a reporter's duty to report things as they are. How many times have you seen a report in which people say your chance of being killed is 1 in 80,000 over an 80-year lifespan? Not too often. And you also get people selling things to the government. We've already talked about that. If you basically have a whole lot of security cameras to sell, you don't go and say, you don't really need this stuff, but if you want to buy it, fine. Instead, obviously, you want to hype the fear. Fear is costly. I was talking to Bruce a couple days ago. I just had this idea that if it's illegal to cry fire in a theater, why isn't it illegal for responsible officials to irresponsibly and without any evidence hype fears of terrorism? For example, Michael Chertoff last year said his gut was telling him that there'd be an attack last summer. And they should have a gut-o-meter probably on their website so we can see what's going on. But the point is that was totally irresponsible. The statement says he has no evidence. His gut is telling him that. It's not that, you know, there's chatter. And it should that be, you know, I think, well... It's at a minimum extremely irresponsible. Okay, let me turn to, there's sort of three studies I've done since the overblown, which I'd like to deal with very briefly. My time is obviously running out here. One is the issue about atomic terrorists, because my numbers that I gave you before obviously are blown out of the water if terrorism get nuclear weapons, and a lot of people are worried about that. So I've got gone through all these studies that say, well, you know, it'd be difficult but not impossible for terrorists to get a nuclear bomb. Difficult but not impossible to get fissile material. Difficult but not impossible to get to subvert people who help you with that. Difficult but not impossible to get out of the border. Difficult but not impossible to set up a machine shop. Difficult but not impossible to get a bunch of Pakistani physicists who could work on it. Difficult but not impossible to get the blueprints. Difficult, you know, et cetera. Well, if you have enough difficult but not impossibles, you got a lot of barriers. So what I did was sort of work out a narrative of what you had to do if you're a nuclear terrorist, and then I came up with 20 reasonable barriers, which I think are also more essentially, they're sequential mostly, but they're independent of each other. At least I tried to make them independent. If you got 20 barriers, which is a low number, I could easily give you 40 or 50 if you want. Some of the barriers, in fact, are really two barriers or three barriers built in. But anyway, take it at 20. If your chance is not difficult, each of these is actually pretty good, namely one chance in three of surviving each barrier, your chance of coming up with a bomb is 1 in 3.5 billion. If it's a 50-50 chance, it's over 1 in a million. Okay, the other couple studies have to deal with cost-benefit analysis. One of the top economists at DHS said recently, you know, we really don't know a whole lot about the overall costs and benefits of Homeland Security. Which I thought was really impressive given that they spent hundreds of billions of dollars on it. And so I'd done a study with a guy, a risk analyst and engineer from Australia, Mark Stewart, trying to estimate what's the value of the of a saved life in terms of Homeland Security. It's a standard thing in the government to have value of saved life. If it costs between $1 and $10 million, then it's usually considered to be cost-effective. Smoke alarms cost about $200,000, for example, for each saved life. So, anyway, standard thing. So we applied that to Tower on Homeland Security, came to the conclusion that it's costing about $180 million per saved life. Let me just quickly read off some ideas about sort of what you should try to protect, principles that you ought to have in a protection situation. I'll end on this. One is that if you're trying to protect things, what should be protected from terrorists? And it seems to me these principles will be important. One, the number of potential terrorist targets is essentially infinite, including this room, for example. The probability that any individual target will be attacked is essentially zero. If one potential target happens to enjoy a degree of protection, an agile terrorist can move on to another one. Anything you do to protect New York makes Boston more dangerous. You have to take that in consideration. Most targets are vulnerable. They can be repaired relatively cheaply, not the World Trade Center, but even the Pentagon could be. And essentially, it's impossible to make a wide variety of targets completely invulnerable. The London Underground is hit on 7/7. They had huge amount of protection. 2 weeks later, more bombs were planted. So anyway, that's some of the basic ideas I'm trying to work with, and let me end on that somewhat cheery note. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation, Bruce. It's a heavy burden I have. I think I'm representing not only the entire field of the arts, but humanities as well, although I guess philosophy is part of that discipline. I ran across Bruce's work several years ago, and the phrase that really resonated with me that he uses is security theater. And I've been trying since then to figure out, well, how can I use that for a book title without stealing it from him, because he's probably going to title a book that way himself some point. But it's very much what we all seem to be talking about, and that is, including John, our last speaker, you know, the reality, the difference between the reality of fear and the use of fear as a currency. And have to forgive me, like most photographers, I'm pretty obsessed with color, and this projector is just pretty green, and there's nothing I can do about it. I'm more or less finished with this work, but for about 3 years, I've traveled to Department of Homeland Security training facilities all over the United States. This particular thing is Terror Town, which is, and it's spelled Terror Town with a little TM after it. It's trademarked. And it's amazing the things that you can find online in marketing. This is run by New Mexico Tech, but it is funded. It's a town in New Mexico that was bought lock, stock, and barrel by with funds from the Department of Homeland Security. At one point, it was a town of about 1,000 people, and now they run exercises. These particular people are members of the Guam SWAT Department, who were flown at our expense from Guam. They were quite shocked to find out that it was about 35 degrees, that in the desert it actually gets cold. But they were training an assault on that house. This is at the Nevada test site where they are training people on dealing in radiological environments. I should explain that I'm a photographer. I work independently as an artist, and when I approach these institutions for permission, I don't say I'm a media guy, although occasionally my work is published in magazines. I'm pretty much a private citizen, a very well-informed private citizen, and I view some of the work that I do as functioning as a bit of a canary in the coal mine of democracy. You know, to find out just what I can see, what I'm allowed to see. Now, what's wrong with this picture? Hard to know where to begin. But this is also a training site. This is a Disaster City, also trademarked in College Station, Texas, which is another one of these sites. Training sites, almost all of which existed in some form prior to 9/11. Prior to 9/11, this site was a fire prevention and firefighting training site. They've all been renamed. Now it's, you know, the Homeland Security Terrorism Prevention Fire Training Site or something like that. But you know, there's a lot of money involved here. Obviously, they're testing some kind of decontamination foam here. But I chose to photograph these in a way that doesn't really betray the artifice and the theatricality. In almost all these situations, this one, for instance, directly behind me was a set of bleachers with other students sitting in the bleachers observing this exercise, and an instructor with a megaphone kind of narrating what was going on. So it's very much a theme park atmosphere. And inside this house are some people play-acting, role-playing as terrorists and hostages. And these are some of the former residents of this town. This is what they do for a living now. And so it's very much, it reminded me of the Christopher Guest film, Waiting for Guffman, because it is, you know, it's kind of community theater, where as the SWAT team approaches, the people are saying, help me, help me. And then the people in the terrible, you know, with their idea of an Arabic accent are saying, Allah Akbar, and they're, you know, setting off stun grenades. So, it's all very amusing in a way. It's disturbing. And I try to maintain kind of a deadpan approach to how I photograph things. Because I know. Well, of course, cultural references. When I was photographing this, I didn't intervene. This is just what they're doing. They're training these people on how to function in bomb suits. And part of it is put them on when it's really hot and walk around the road. And I kept looking through my camera thinking, I like this picture. I really like this picture. And I didn't think about why. Of course, you know, it's Abbey Road. This is also in Terror Town, where they're practicing breach techniques for entering homes. These are a couple of places where they explode bombs, car bombs, to demonstrate. And someone earlier talked about the idea of doing something because it really helps to feel like you're doing something. And I guess I don't pass judgment on this work. I'm glad that people train in hazmat suits. It seems like a good idea. You know, I'm glad that they do this explosives training. Well, one of these, by the way, is a Toyota Celica, and the other is a Honda Civic. And it is amazing, you know, to see one of these things go off with 300 or 500 pounds of ANFO explosive. It's, you know, it makes an impression. I also did a series of portraits, and these are not really documentary photographs. Although what we're seeing here is real, but there's very much a sense of artifice in how I did these. They're shot on location in these backgrounds. These are not done in a studio, although they kind of have that look of being dropped in and heavily photoshopped, which they were heavily photoshopped. But a lot of it was just as an artist trying to deal visually with the question that at the start of the Iraq War, the most recent one, you know, what is real? Weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Real, not real. You know, that question kind of permeated, I think, our national life at the time. And so these are sort of modeled after the 18th and 19th century portraiture tradition of, you know, the rich and the powerful. Though this one's more the Marvel comic version of that. This is a SWAT officer. I know I have some libertarian friends that are very much of the libertarian bent. I don't happen to lean that way, but they find this very disturbing because police officers are not supposed to be militarized. This guy's not a soldier. He looks like a soldier. He's armed like a soldier. Probably smells like a soldier. But he's not a soldier. He's a cop. He's a Tucson police officer. And I'm going to show just a few earlier pictures that are not quite related, although they are in a sense, just to make the point that I've been at some pretty scary places. For about 10 or 12 years, I photographed the U.S. nuclear weapon arsenal all across the country. And, you know, to me, the interesting point here is that obviously I didn't sneak into these places. The government let me, not easily. And again, this is my thinking about the canary in the coal mine. I worked very hard to get access. I spent years sometimes to get permission to photograph one place. And I was, again, not representing the media. I would write letters to the Pentagon and saying that I'm an artist that intends to demystify. And, you know, I figured out how to not lie to them, because lying is not a good policy in any field of endeavor, but how to convince them that my interests and their interests overlapped to some extent. But I wasn't shown anything that didn't benefit them to some extent. And again, this gets back to the subject of the currency of fear. During the Cold War, deterrence very much used the currency of fear. The trick at that time was to terrorize our enemies without terrorizing our citizens too much, you know, and it's kind of a fine balance that they had to achieve with that. But in order to terrorize our enemies, we had to show our nuclear weapons and show them that they're real. And part of it, I think, was allowing people like me in the photograph. This was the last photograph I did. This was in August of 2001. This is a submarine base in Georgia, which was, of course, 1 month before 9/11. And as I'm reminded over and over by people since then, well, everything's changed. That's what you hear in the security field. And I didn't even bother to ask for permission to photograph those anymore. And I'm going to show just a few very recent things. And I'm going to see how we're going to play a little guessing game. I just last week did these four photographs. I was in Texas and Louisiana. This is a Big Hill, which is near Winnie, Texas. This is called Bayou Choctaw, which is near Baton Rouge, Louisiana. This is near Freeport, Texas. The site's called Big Hill. And this is West Hackberry, which is in Louisiana. Does anybody have any idea what these four landscapes represent? Yes.
Missile sites?
I'm sorry?
Missiles?
No, they're not missile sites. No, yeah.
Terrorist targets?
Well, yes, that's partially right. We'll you get half credit for that. Yeah.
No.
These are the sites of the Strategic Oil Reserve, which are four sites that contain a total of 700 million barrels of oil. You know, it's an interesting security question. Is it a good idea for our security to store 700 million barrels of oil underground? I don't really know. And this is just a snapshot that I took while I'm down there. I'm going to finish up with this and the other one and talk a little bit about my work as a photographer. And I'm a professional photographer. I do this for a living. I've spent a long, long time dealing with security institutions in the government. It's legal to take a photograph anywhere of anything in this country from a public roadway or from public land. And yet there are law enforcement officers, and a bigger problem is rent-a-cops who work for a lot of industrial institutions that are going up to photographers and saying, you can't take a picture of that. And in fact, when I was making the arrangements to do these, for over a year I was talking with the Department of Energy who runs these sites, and finally got through to the head of security for these sites about a year ago and had several conversations with him. And basically I told him, well, I know that this is legal and I understand you don't want me to photograph, and I requested permission to come on site, and they said no. And I said, okay, what I really want to do is landscape, so I'm going to photograph from outside of your site. And he said, well, we don't want you to do that either. And I said, basically, well, I'm probably going to do it anyway, so how can we work together to make it less difficult for both of us? And he said on the phone, well, just yesterday we confiscated some guy's pictures. And I said, oh, was he photographing illegally? And he said, well, no, he gave them to us. So what does that mean? It means that they intimidated him, and he handed over his film. I don't know if he was probably just some amateur guy. So this was a sign painted on the side of an oil tank. I was just driving by. I had made no arrangements to come to this place. And this is the setting. And I just thought, well, that's kind of ironic and kind of funny. And I pulled out my little pocket digital camera. And I thought, no, if I pull over there, the cops are going to be all over me, because I hadn't made any arrangements. And this is, you know, this huge oil refinery. So I drove on by. But I thought, you know, I'm a citizen, it's legal, and I'm going to go back and do it. But I was scared to death, and I'm a guy who knows a lot about this stuff. I pulled into this parking lot for 20 seconds, whipped out my camera, took this picture, and, you know, I knew if I stayed there that the police were going to come confront me and delay me from doing the things that I had gone down there to do. For the Brits among us, you may have seen this, or for Frank, or people who have lived in England, thousands of people take photos every day. What if one of them seems odd? This was a campaign in England. Terrorists use surveillance to help plan attacks, taking photos and making notes about security measures like the location of CCTV cameras. If you see someone doing that, we need to know. Let experienced officers decide what action to take. So, thank you.
Thank you.
I have a comment, a question for John. You know, your analysis in which you talk about the expected deaths from terrorism and so forth, you know, one chance in, what was it,
80,000?
Yeah.
Over 80 years.
The only thing is, and I'm coming from basing this on work I presented yesterday, the fusion of terror and so forth, is that when we look at the public's response to disasters, and most particularly intentional disasters, terrorism, crime, and things, and we looked at the things that they pay attention to that really cause fear. Interestingly enough, paradoxically enough, the number of people who die doesn't seem to be high in the list. In other words, when we look at perceptions of risk, fear, anger, and we look at the things that predict that, terrorism looms large. The mechanism used looms large, i.e., you introduce some infectious disease versus some other way to do it. And so I think we need to be sensitive to other issues besides the number of people dying. I mean, it's human beings are remarkably numb to this. Case in point, the impact of 9/11 that killed 3,000 people tragically versus the tsunami in Southeast Asia that killed over 200,000, or, as we speak, the terrorist activity, I think we should call it that, that's going on in Africa, as we speak, that you can hardly get Americans to pay attention to, quite frankly. It's a larger issue, and your comments about Chernobyl are very interesting. I mentioned that my advisor, Paul Slover, yesterday, he actually traveled over to Chernobyl after. And the reason he did, with a handful of scientists, were there was, at the time of Chernobyl, there was so much distrust among the folks there about the government and that telling the truth about how dangerous it was. They had to bring in Western scientists to help the citizens assess. So it's not surprising to me to later learn that the people were dying not so much from radiation, but from the fear. What would happen. It speaks to this real problem we have if we're afraid of invisible stuff that we don't know. And one of the things that Paul Slovak mentioned at the time was that they were having a real problem with this, is that in surrounding villages, parents whose kids were coming down with the flu, and the flu is mimics all sorts of bad stuff. And it's usually the flu, but it could be other stuff. They couldn't tell the difference. They'd go to doctors and wouldn't believe the doctors that it wasn't radiation poisoning.
They also don't believe the Western experts. They're really angry at the Western experts for downplaying the degree of radiation damage.
Yeah, it was a hell of a mess.
Yes, yeah, I agree just about everything you said. The question, I think the fear is bottom up. In other words, I don't think it's the politicians that are making the fear. They're stoking it. Paul Slovak, of course, done some of the best stuff ever on risk communication, and it's a nightmare. If you try to downplay a risk, and people become more afraid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you say, and just trying to figure out how to assess it. But what bothers me is public officials are actively exacerbating it, and insofar as they're successful at that, they are causing real damage. It may be that you can't say it. Okay, you can't. If they say one chance in 80,000, people are still afraid. It certainly is in the case of polls. If you ask people, how worried are you that you might be killed by a terrorist? You still get very large numbers of people, even now, who really at least say they're concerned about it. And so some effort should be made to try to get that into context, and it's simply not there. For example, the case that might be in most interesting would be journalists. Why can't you say there's a terrorist attack in the next paragraph, the next line, say, however, your chance of being killed by a terrorist already, your lifespan is about 1 in 80,000. Just putting it in context. People may still be afraid, but at least the context is there, and it's not there. The Department of Homeland Security, on its opening, in its manifesto, has a line saying a terrorist could strike at any time, at any place, and with virtually any weapon, which I suppose is sort of true in some sense. Now, the next line said, however, the chance of you being killed by one is, etc., at least in context. But the second line isn't there. Now, maybe the second line won't help. People will still be afraid, which is what you're partly saying.
Doesn't seem to help. That's the problem. I mean, they could say it, and it would be responsible for journalists to do it that way. Part of the problem, incidentally, is that an awful lot of the journalists that report on this have virtually very poor scientific training.
Yeah, but they do it on the sports page. Someone gets four home runs in a game, and there's all kinds of context.
Sports reporters are a lot better calibrated.
Put them on the front page.
Than the other one. Yeah.
Brent or Bob, New York Times, MSNBC, would you like to?
You want me to talk about four home runs in a game?
Frank.
Right, so thank you to this panel. This was really fascinating, and I appreciate the insights of the speakers, particularly Bruce's comment that something that is obvious to many of us, but is rarely heard, that the real aim of terrorists is not to destroy the whole country, perhaps just to drive them out of the Middle East. Now, another thing that isn't often pointed out is that when this fear is marketed, it's marketed in a way to say, well, and the way to get rid of this problem is to spend more on defense. And the thing that I would like to point out is how, with the amount of weaponry that a country such as U.S. has, it's impossible to do war against U.S. in any other way than by terrorist means. I mean, I'm not condoning any motives, but I'm saying there's no way you can do conventional war against the U.S. if they have 100 times more weapons than you have. What's your comment on that?
While you're talking, I pulled up the article. There's something else that Abrams said that was very interesting. What he did was he looked at 28 terrorist groups and their policy objectives. And he has 42 policy objectives. And he figured out what actually happened. And with some very, very generous definitions of achieve their objectives, the terrorist groups achieved about 7% of them. And this is like the Tunnel Tigers and the IRA over. I don't have the number of years they've looked, and that terrorism is more likely to work. You know, when did it work? I mean, it's unlikely to work, but it's more likely to work if the terrorists limit their attacks to military targets, if they have minimalist goals like, you know, evicting a foreign power out of your country, than maximal goals like changing the government of the United States. So those two things make terrorism more likely. And what's interesting is that when you look at correspondent inference theory, that the goals are not something that the victims of the terrorists see, especially in large-scale terrorism. So when Bin Laden attacks the United States, we don't see, we should get out of Saudi Arabia, we see they're trying to kill us. And our reactions are to perceived goals and not the actual goals. Bush's misinterpretation of the terrorist motives actually helps prevent them from achieving their motives. So there's a lot of weird stuff going on here. This fundamental misinterpretation actually makes terrorism less likely to fail. I mean, if you pull the United States and said, well, if we get, you know, U.S. troops out of Saudi Arabia, terrorists will go away, and if people believe that, I think people are likely to say, well, what the hell, let's get out of Saudi Arabia. Who really cares about Saudi Arabia? Because we don't buy that will appease them. That foreign policy conversation never takes place.
Bruce, I think more than 7% of the insurgencies in the last century were successful. Eamon de Valera, Nelson Mandela, Robert Mugabe, Menachem Begin, one could go on for several pages.
Right, and he has a way of defining terrorists as opposed to insurgency. It's worth reading. So he'll look at that as terrorist attacks versus something like Mugabe or...
What's the reference?
Max Hayes, the Journal International. It's got two articles.
The paper's called Why Terrorism Doesn't Work. The author is Max Abrams, and that's probably enough for Google to find it.
The Journal's International Security Center.
There's a PDF of the essay online, the journal article online, so it is available online.
Is that where 70% comes from?
7%, not 70.
Okay. We assume that there's Al-Qaeda with its objectives, which there is. But actually, as somebody said, he said there are a very small number of people. The real terrorism is not Al-Qaeda in the way that it's conventionally presented. It's when you get a bunch of kids in Belgium or Oldham in England who are second or third generation Muslim who really feel alienated, disoriented from their society, who wake up one morning and they feel that the way they give expression to that alienation is by putting a bomb somewhere, and in conjunction with others, that creates this kind of dynamic. And the problem that we have is on both sides, there's a lack of meaning. You know, when President Bush says, why did they hate us? You know, why did they hate us? He's basically saying he doesn't understand what's going on. And in some sense, well, in some sense, he's actually quite right. He's basically indicating, I haven't got a clue what is really going on. But when you listen to the websites of the jihadists, and I've done a lot of work on that with some other people, you look at their websites, they themselves don't know what they want. Well, I think we're very clear on this. You know, if Britain or America pulled out of the Middle East, if Israelis pulled out of Palestine, all of a sudden nothing would change. Right? Nothing would change for the very simple reason that there's a dynamic in place of disorientation on both sides, and that's the kind of condition that we live in the 21st century. So the conventional categories of international relations and of political ideology do not apply to conditions where people themselves have a sort of this dissonance between their subjective intent and a very kind of diffuse sense of their objectives. And that's something that we do need to take on board.
Yeah. John, you're saying it's very convincing that the terrorist threat has largely withered away in Al-Qaeda's extended force. Why are our politicians not declaring victory? I mean, President Bush is quick enough to say mission accomplished in Iraq long before he arrived to do so. In this particular respect, nobody wants to know that they've won. What's going on there?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm not really sure. They're afraid this. First place, it may be wrong, and they could have regeneration. And there's a big debate about this going on in the current issue of foreign affairs, actually. So they're sort of afraid of looking foolish because then there'll be an explosion someplace. But the head of the CIA only recently did say more or less that they've been pushed by the failure in Iraq, which is not more an insurgency than terrorism, it's being set back in a lot of other places. So some of that is being said. But then the next day in the Washington Post, there was another interview with some other officials saying, well, they're still reconstituting themselves and so forth.
I think it's
there's a sort of CYA problem in all this, basically. You don't want to look like predict things are getting better, and then they get bad and you look foolish.
I think there's also a very strong political dimension. That running on fear of terrorism is just as good as running on fear of communism. So it's the new bugaboo. And there is a lot of politics in us being afraid and allowing a lot of laws to pass. I think it's also a strong cognitive dissonance. If we won, but we haven't actually done much that's visible, how do we win?
So I think
declaring victory invites a conversation that might be... that people might not want to have as to how big was the threat in the first place if we won so easily without actually doing anything interesting.
It's interesting to look for other models in which insurgencies or threats have come to an end and how they've ended. I mean, Northern Ireland is perhaps an interesting example. It's clear that the IRA lost public support. It's directly like Al-Qaeda. And we actually want to that there's no methods anymore. Nonetheless, it took a kind of public truce for anybody to believe that actually it had come to an end. And maybe if the British government simply said, okay, it's over now, it wouldn't have been as effective as giving the IRA, the crew had failed, the credit for coming to terms. And maybe in some sense we need actually to now an armistice with people who actually
there's a danger that because terrorism can be done by anybody, like crime, one person, that if you declare we've won, and then the latest provisional, reprovisional, whatever IRA forms itself, and then blows up a school someplace, there's a danger of that seeming to refute.
But in fact, of course, it is what happened.
Yeah, you just want to be careful when the policy stands. I was invited to give a breakfast for some Congress people about a few months ago, the first statement was sort of what I talked about. Then the first one talked about nuclear weapons. The second question from a congressman was, "What happens when you say this to real people?" And in other words, if I say that, in other words, and politicians want to get reelected, and they don't, so there's a real wariness. That's perfectly understandable.
The economic aspect too is huge. I mean, there's a lot of motivation to not declare this over. there's a reason why it's called the War on Terror. It's a never-ending thing. And I'm not just talking about the military overseas work, but the things that I photographed, the domestic preparedness is a huge industry. I've attended 2 conventions in Washington, 2 trade shows, and there's a lot of money flying around.
Well, one of the things I think that you see is DHS is transitioning the War on Terror to sort of an all-hazards kind of program, so that you can't really criticize money spent on terrorism, because it's also for hurricanes and floods and earthquakes and just general preparedness. So that's the good news kind of.
Yeah, although they... Apparently, it did too well with Katrina for that very reason.
All the more reason to
spend
Stuart? So, I just want to quickly, I think one of the reasons why you might not hear a declaration of victory is that we never got Osama, right? So, if the current administration were to say, okay, we think we did it, then they'd be inviting the discussion about whatever happened with the guy, you know, catching the guy, the first original goal we had.
October.
I'm a little worried when people discuss the probability of something in the future based on the probability of what's happened in the past, especially given that the technology keeps increasing the force multiplier, as the military would call it. While I don't like the paranoia in my government, I do like some paranoia in science about before we invent the next thing. I like people thinking about how the technology could be used not just for good but for bad, and assuming that future probabilities equal past probabilities can take people away from doing that.
Yeah, well, and what I'm doing with the numbers, of course, is assuming that the trend will continue and it may change, except the trend, if anything, is going down, the amount of Al-Qaeda type attacks. Also, I did discuss, obviously, nuclear weapons, which would obviously massively change it. And the people that are left basically don't exactly seem to be a monumental technological threat. I mean, the terrorists or the people fighting in Iraq have not even used chemical weapons. I mean, they know Saddam Hussein had them at one time, used them. They may not have anything there to make them with, but you could get it in. And so a lot of people in Iraq know a lot about chemical weapons, and they hate the Americans, and they're not using them. So, you know, they haven't got to step one technologically, but obviously conceivably that could change.
If the questions are brief, we have time for 2 more questions. In my list, I had Sasha and Mark.
I'll address this to Frank first, and then to anyone else, I guess. So they make the distinction between these actual and perceived countermeasures for the street crime or information security, and terrorism, I guess. Any insights on when or if the perceived activities may actually be better, especially or even in the long term?
Well, I think the interesting thing is that at a certain point, the perceived threat can acquire a reality about it. For example, there is now a professional medicine which isn't just simply dealing with chronic diseases, but with the fear of chronic diseases, because they realize that once you begin to worry about getting cancer, you spend more money managing the fear of cancer than sometimes cancer itself. So that's the kind of the negative side. I take the view, and maybe I'm a bit extreme on this, that fear can never have positive effects when it's disassociated from reality. It's the fear of a lion running towards you can lead to productive, you know, sort of outcomes by using the kind of innovating weapons. You learn to get fast tractions to run away. I mean, all kinds of things can happen that are good. But the fear of
faster than the other guy.
Well, something like that. But the fear of, that's based upon a disassociation of reality always breeds even more anxiety, and that's the dynamic that we face at the moment. It always disorients us and makes us less able to assume any degree of control over our existence.
So is that a no? Is that there be no cases where it would be preferred?
Well, I cannot. Some people argue that the motto "better safe than sorry" is how we should live our lives, and people argue, for example, that okay, so we don't know for sure. But the fact that we've taken these precautions may well have some ripple effects, you know, somewhere else. And I think that if that happens as a byproduct, that may well happen, but the damage that's done far outweighs the benefits that may come about as a result of that.
I'm sorry, I'm better safe than sorry means never get married.
Never cross the street.
Never have kids.
Mark, final question. We're going to be fast because you sort of covered it, which was the value-added aspect of it. By preparing for one thing, you discover other things. So Massachusetts discovered there were 473 different jurisdictions, and they had about 12 or 15 different hose sizes. You know, and so they were, you know, one location was responding to another, and so on. But you started to address that. So there can be, if you narrow it too much on just terrorism, sometimes it looks a little bit goofy. But if it has benefits in other domains, then you got to probably change the equation a little bit.
I'll write about that. I mean, yes, I mean certain countermeasures are just general enough. I mean, general emergency response is useful for terrorist attacks, natural disasters. I mean, even 9/11, I mean, the cause was intentional, but you could have imagined that as an accident. Something happened like that during World War II. Once the plane hits, it's all the same disaster. You know, it doesn't matter whether it's... So yes, stuff that's general like that, preparedness, hose sizes.
Well, the interesting thing is all the things that worked after 9/11 were not perceived in advance. I mean, they're emergent solutions that people creatively innovated. And that is why all these attempts to kind of second guess what's going to happen often obscure the fact that real human beings, you know, make their own way, create and innovate. And that's what happened after 9/11, that's what happened after all emergencies. And that's what we're going to learn from.
So I saw a few more hands raised. I hope this will make for a good lunchtime discussion. On the way out, you can pick up the list of attendees, and then we will meet again for the next session. Please join me in thanking the...